Hi, I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright.
And we are historians. If this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We're here in Adelaide to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to season two of our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we conduct intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians, and other victims of the research bug.
We talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating, and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And we ask the question, what madness is this?
Today on Archive Fever, we're heading out into space with archaeologist Dr. Alice Gorman, an internationally renowned expert in the developing field of space archaeology. Alice, who's also known as Dr. Space Junk, is the author of Dr. Space Junk versus the Universe, Archaeology and the Future, published by New South in 2019. She's also worked extensively in Indigenous heritage management and is currently Associate Professor in Archaeology at Flinders University in Adelaide. Welcome to Archive Fever, Alice.
Thank you for having me on your wonderful podcast.
Now, Alice, we'll get to space archaeology in a moment, but first let's go back to where it all began. How did you first get Archive Fever? Was it at university or does it date back into your childhood?
I think it probably dates to my career as a young heritage consultant, which I started when I was maybe 22 or 23. And when you're working in heritage in Australia, you have to do background research on the places, the geography, the geology, the history, the events. And this often takes you to, well, actually one of my favourite places to do research, which is the local history collection in the local library, but also into the National Archives, State Archives, all kinds of places where you're tracking down information about what happened in a particular place and pulling it out so you can assess the cultural significance of an object or a landscape or whatever it is. So I think it was there. It came to be almost my favourite part of the whole archaeological project, actually pottering around in the archives, reading things that you knew sometimes it was in a file that no one had looked at, maybe ever, but there you were with the crinkly paper and the binding things that keep all the pages, I don't even know the right word for them, that keep them all together, and the sense of the preciousness of these documents, the most mundane piece of information that suddenly leaps out as terribly significant in that context. So yeah, in my early 20s, I guess, it became one of my favourite things to do.
Yeah, so it sounds like you really got full-blown archive fever early on. I mean, what did that feel like for you? You've kind of alluded to it being a very exciting, thrilling experience. Some people talk about archive fever as a kind of stressful sense of panic. Was it ever like that for you, or was it just kind of
complete? Oh, look, the panic is definitely there, because in the old days, if I can refer to them as old days, you would go into the archive with your pencil, and that was all you had. And you would write for 8 hours straight. And you would do that day after day. And if you had enough money, then you might be able to afford to get a document actually photocopied for you if it was in a sufficient condition. So you saved up and hoarded that money to copy the really essential documents. So there was always that sense of panic. Will I get everything I need in the time I've allocated to do this? And now, of course, you know, you just take your phone in and click, 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 and you've got it all there. So there was definitely that sense of panic. But I think also it was, for me, this massive realization that, you know, we have our sort of history books and we have accounts of Australian politics and all of that stuff. And they're the tip of the iceberg. There is endless volumes, meters of material that no one has ever looked at or assessed that contains in it stories that have not yet ever come to light. So the process of dipping into that, you know, I would generally, as I suppose everybody does, be doing that for a particular purpose at a particular time, but it would be also the other stuff that, can I tell a story now?
Oh, we love stories.
So this was actually when I had first moved to Adelaide I was working as a casual academic, which, as you know, is a fairly precarious kind of life. And one of my colleagues had asked me to go in and do some research in the state records for their work, which was up in the Northern Territory. So in those days, the Northern Territory and South Australia were governed from Adelaide. So there's a heap of Northern Territory stuff in state records. And I started to see in telegrams, so these were actual telegrams, some really odd sentences, like really funny sentences that didn't make sense to me. And I saw a couple and just sort of, you know, dismissed them. And then I saw a couple more and a couple more, and some patterns started to leap out at me. And what I was reading was a code. And this code was a simple word substitution code. So if we had found the little code book, it would have said, you know, when you say want to say walk, say fish. And this would lead, because they hadn't kind of declined the verbs or anything, this would lead to someone wanted to say, well, they walked over here, but there's no past tense, or they say they fished over here. And so you had this really funny words being in the wrong place and then being grammatically the changed wrong, to fit into it. So what is going on here? I've never heard of this. And by this time I had spent a lot of time in sort of colonial archives, I guess. I've never seen anything like this before. So I started to keep a little log. The meaning was not all that obscure.
Yeah, I was going to say, did you crack the code? Yeah.
I cracked part of it. And what these telegrams and correspondence was about was about a massacre that had happened in the Northern Territory. So this is in, I forget the date, but it's, you know, 1800s sometime. So some Aboriginal people had been murdered by some white settlers, and the white settlers were up for trial, and so they were coding all these telegrams so that nobody could tell that they were discussing this forthcoming trial.
Alice, who are the telegrams from and to?
I've forgotten, but clearly they were government officials of some kind, because the state records has all of that stuff. The thing that struck me was somewhere there was a code book. There was a little thing that, you know, they were madly looking up. What word do we need for this? I thought, that has to exist somewhere. So Heather Burke, who was the person I was working with on this, I said to her, we've got to find this code book. It's got to be somewhere. So we went trawling through every source we could find, and we never found it.
Wow.
And you might be able to find it now, because there's so much more stuff.
There you go, archive addicts. There's some homework for you. Go out and find that code book and get back to us.
And so how did you get from your background in sort of heritage management and working in Australia's Indigenous archaeology to space archaeology? How did that come about? And, you know, perhaps we should step back a bit and say, what is space archaeology at all?
Okay, let's start with your second question. Yeah, it's a funny term, space archaeology.
Mm.
The word archaeology itself obviously has that Greek prefix, arche, which means old. But archaeology is, in fact, a set of methods and theories that is applied to understanding how humans interact with the material world, with environments and objects and places. So if you take that definition, then it doesn't have to be old. It can be contemporary. It can be, you know, heading into the future. It can be virtual. I have colleagues who are doing archaeological studies of video games. Most archaeologists, I guess, are obsessed with objects and things and materials and the sensory experience of sort of being surrounded by physical stuff. And a lot of archaeologists are also massive science fiction fans. So in some ways it's not that much of a leap, but for me there was a particular moment where my main research interest became space. And it actually came through the heritage angle. So this was before I was an employed academic. I was still working as a heritage consultant. And because I was so deep in that whole process of heritage management and assessing cultural significance and management recommendations and all of that kind of stuff, I just had a revelation one night while I was looking at the stars, thinking about space junk in Earth orbit. So there's a thing called the Burra Charter, which is a very well-known Australian charter for managing cultural significance of places. It's used across the world because it's so well put together, I suppose. And so I use it, as do most of my colleagues and peers all the time. So I was thinking space junk, you know, and then I thought, well, does the Barachata work in space? Can I apply it to space? And I kind of thought, well, probably yes, but I don't know. I don't know until I've tried. I mean, does it work off the Earth? Is it completely earthbound? So that kind of started a journey to investigating the junk that was in Earth orbit and what it might mean for people on Earth and what it might mean as an archaeological record.
So what actually is space junk? So there's Alice standing there looking up at the stars and wondering about the space junk. I don't even know what it is.
That is a bloody good question, because that word junk, it's like you think junk, I know what junk is. Junk is the stuff that you throw out in the weekly garbage. Junk is the stuff that you see at the tip. So part of that concept does apply. It's stuff that's discarded. It's stuff that's useless. And in satellite terms, this means satellites that don't work anymore, their mission life has ended, so they might technically work, but no one is operating them or using their data. It means the fragments of things as they break up or explode or get hit by other stuff. So the fragments in themselves don't have any function or purpose. And we're getting an increasing number of those fragments as we put more stuff up there and more collisions occur. So there's whole stuff, like whole spacecraft, and then there's every kind of fragment from large chunks down to sub-millimeter-sized particles.
And all this detritus is just up there floating around.
Yeah, pretty much. The lowest stuff gets dragged back into the atmosphere and burnt up, but the higher you go, the longer that process takes, and at some altitudes it will never happen. That stuff is up there for pretty much ever.
So if you're sort of Dr. Space Junk, we could say that space junk is your archive in a sense.
Yeah, you could say that.
You could. But then it's an archive that, you know, as we've just said, is up in space floating around. So which makes it very different to the kind of other archaeological archives where you can go and, you know, pick up and touch and measure physical objects. How do you relate to that archive if it's so far away?
For me, as an archaeologist, I was always the filthiest person on any excavation site. Like somehow or other, I would be covered in dirt from top to toe when everybody else, you know, still had their work clothes quite pristine. So for me, that incredible physicality and engagement with the actual soil deposits was, you know, always a big thing. I could never get the dirt out from under my fingernails, and my colleagues used to look at my hands with slight horror, but I did do the best I could. So here I am, you know, looking at this stuff that I can't go to, I can't see, except in a certain limited way. I can't engage with, I can't measure anything on it. So I'm basically studying these objects by proxy. Mm-hmm. So using the registration information for when they're launched, often it will be archival information. The stuff that's published online, there's quite a number of sort of sources you can go to get basic, like it weighs this much, it was of these dimensions, it was made of these materials. But a lot of these things are engineering specifications. Mm-hmm. So they're not as rich and descriptive as the sort of stuff that I am interested in.
Yeah.
So some of that then becomes, well, reconstructing. Some of it for me is like taking all these bits of information to imagine the whole object. You'll often have photographs as well, but often not. So people have an assumption that everything is documented. And you know what it's like some things you have, there's too much documentation, and then there's massive gaps where no one thought to take that picture or write down that piece of information. And for a lot of these spacecraft, these massive gaps exist. So it can be really quite hard to find out very basic information about the spacecraft. But the interesting thing about that is we actually need that information because there's a whole massive research field and industry field in figuring out how we actually mitigate the dangers of space junk. And to do that, we need to know the precise material something was made out of. If it was or wasn't different to the specifications that were published, what we now know of how that material survives in space or how it's gone in tests on Earth. While I'm interested in this stuff because I want to understand the object, there's actually a practical application. Engineers, In general, the minute a mission is over, they've moved on to the next thing. They're not thinking about this, but it's a very archaeological way to think. Let's follow this object into its current environment, into its current situation, think about what condition it's in, think about how we extract information from it. So I think there's a really interesting synergy between that archive, as you say, and some practical applications.
So it sounds a bit like space archaeology is like paleontology, in that we don't really know what dinosaurs looked like, but we have to put together a picture of them from all the other sources of evidence that would suggest that that's what a stegosaurus looked like. But there's actually more of a reason to have space archaeology. It always sort of struck me that having that whole range of dinosaurs looking like that was just to keep preschoolers occupied for long periods of time.
And, of course, now we know that a lot of dinosaurs were feathered. So all of those pictures we see in books will have to be redrawn with beautiful iridescent feathers. Yeah, so I think there really is a gap there. Like, for a lot of satellites, well, the photographs that exist of them are not necessarily
what they look like. And also, the photographs that exist of them are not necessarily what they look like now, because maybe bits of them have fallen off.
And so there's a sort of a little jigsaw puzzle that's not really a great metaphor, but to be done. Like, you go from the basic information and then the environmental information. So in archaeology we call that taphonomy, to work out what the impacts on the object are, and then if you look at it right now, how then you trace that back to what it originally was. I mean, one of the big things in archaeology is that, you know, people say, oh, this is what this thing is and this is what happened. It doesn't mean they did that, and it doesn't mean it was like that. I think there's lots of stories in the history sphere where there's an account of a battle and someone goes to the place and, well, there's actually a hill in the middle of where they said this happened, so it clearly didn't happen like that. So I think that really works for bits of space junk as well. There's the sort of received wisdom of what something was, but when you start to delve deeper into it, you discover that it might not. And, of course, with space junk we have the added aspect that a lot of it is military in nature. There's a lot of classified stuff. It's not unlike when you're in the field with traditional owners and there's something that you're not supposed to know. Often it's not possible for them to come out directly and say, listen, you know, they have to obliquely refer to it, and you have to sort of just be attuned to the fact that here's something that you should just not participate in at this moment. And in fact, it's not unlike sometimes where you're on the trail of something and you sort of start to come up against little walls, and then after a while it sort of clicks into place. It's classified, and if you get further enough it's black. You won't get far enough to know when it's black, but you know that once you start to hit those little walls, then you're actually not going to get any further, and you just have to let it go or rely on someone to tell you, which they sometimes do. They will just say, oh, that, it's da-da-da-da. So that's always kind of interesting to me.
It sounds like when you do space archaeology, there's multiple layers of distance between you and what you're studying. You know, there's the physical distance of all the objects being up in space, but also this issue of secrecy and classification. I'm interested in how that might affect the kind of emotional engagement with your work. You know, you mentioned a few minutes ago the kind of thrill of being in an archive or out in the field and touching things that, you know, haven't been touched for years. But when you have this really intense distance, is it hard to feel that engaged, that impassionate?
Yes and no. I guess something that really intrigues me about this whole thing is forming emotional engagements with these objects that are both very technical, very industrial, often not beautiful in the way people like heritage to be beautiful, and very, very far away. But interestingly, lots of people and communities actually do have very strong emotional attachments to some of these spacecraft, and even after they turn into junk, they still have those attachments. And something I find a lot is when I'm talking to the aerospace engineers, sometimes I will just ask them, so, you know, how do you feel about this project that you worked on for years and years and years? So what are your reflections upon that? What emotions do you have? And quite frequently I'll get maybe a little odd look, and sometimes they'll say, oh, no one's ever asked me that before. I've never had to think about that before. By asking those questions, I give them permission to talk about how they feel. And it probably doesn't hurt that I'm, you know, I'm a female archaeologist, so I'm maybe someone you can express this stuff to who isn't going to judge them in the same way. So I often get really interesting responses about how, you know, they still think of this object, even though, you know, they worked on it 20 years ago, but it was their favourite one to work on, or at the time how, you know, the pride and pleasure they might have felt about working on that particular project. So actually a lot of positive emotions, I guess, when I think about it, but often it's the first time anybody's given them space to just express that. And there's a strong movement against anthropomorphizing spacecraft. So people say it's ridiculous, we shouldn't do it, they're robots, they're inanimate, they're da-da-da-da. But actually, I don't give a damn. I actually think it's quite wonderful, and even more so now with social media. So many spacecraft have their own Twitter accounts and have followings. So recent examples, I guess, the Cassini mission to Saturn that ended up falling into Saturn's outer layers and getting consumed. People shed tears and join together, like people are all talking about it, how they feel. And you know, sometimes the most sober senior planetary scientists and satellite and spacecraft engineers are like mourning for this object that has effectively died. And when this kind of thing happens, you know, there's all these people saying, oh, come on, don't be ridiculous, da, da. But that's what heritage is about. It's that attachments people feel for things. And why shouldn't people be allowed to feel close to a spacecraft that's 50 astronomical units away?
Do all spacecraft have names, like ships have names? Are there a bunch of Titanics who are marooned up there?
They do all have names. Some of them are very boring names, like TDR-1. The military ones probably get boring names. So the USSR and now Russia just calls a whole bunch of things Cosmos. So there's like hundreds and hundreds of Cosmoses or Cosmoi, and you don't know what they are. A lot of them are military satellites. So others are given very specific names that have a symbolic meaning that people can relate to as well. They're very analogous to a ship name, but they also become like a personal name. You say Voyager and everybody knows what you mean. And Voyager 2 is one of my all-time favourites. So they were both launched in 1977. And of course, Carl Sagan and his team made the famous golden records, which were sent out on the two spacecraft with 90 minutes of music, greetings in different languages of Earth, two pieces of Aboriginal music, interestingly, photographs and a whole bunch of stuff. So that has great symbolic appeal for people on Earth as well. But Voyager 1 reached interstellar space first, so it's kind of the more famous one, the one that's much more lauded and which people think about. And its twin, Voyager 2, which got to interstellar space much later, people kind of forget about it. They just roll them into the one spacecraft. I like Voyager 2 best because it's slightly forgotten and slightly overlooked. So that's the one that has the more powerful emotional attraction for me.
Excuse my space ignorance, but are they both still up there?
Oh, yes. 40,000 years from now, Voyager 1 will start to approach another star system. It's unlikely anything will destroy them completely before that time. Their instruments will stop transmitting by 2030, probably. So we won't be able to talk to them or hear them, but they will still be out there. They're not tiny. They're as big as this room, but they are tiny in comparison to the space they're in. So they'll still be sailing out there to other star systems.
So, Alice, this all sounds like the stuff of science fiction, but what you're telling us is this is science fact, and we know it's fact because there's evidence, and you're uncovering the evidence. That gives you a particular kind of responsibility for proving that something that is to all intents and purposes gone, invisible, actually exists, and therefore I think somehow in the human psyche might return. It's almost like Freud's return of the repressed, like at some stage these things might come back.
I think listening to how you're articulating this, it's kind of a sense of being haunted by these spacecraft. And we know that space-time, We know the universe is curved in some way that a cosmologist would describe far, far better than I. And we know there are wormholey things there, and we know there are these, you know, the universe is probably a hyperdimensional sphere or possibly a torus of some kind. It's not just like Euclidean, geometric, Cartesian, three-dimensional space that we're in now. The future could become the past at some point. And maybe we will meet these objects we've sent out coming back as we head forward in the future in new kinds of spacecraft. One thing that's often said about the Voyager spacecraft and a few of the others that have these objects on them is that they're a time capsule, and the expectation is a time capsule will be opened at some point in the future. Even though that's probably not going to happen for any of these, the Voyagers or the Pioneers or any of the others that have carried these little messages out, what you're referring to is kind of the expectation, like they have some kind of soul, and that soul persists, and it persists somehow simultaneously in all spaces and times where we might be able to encounter it. It's a concept of anamnesis. It's knowing what we already knew before. It's the thing that we get embodied, and we meet our previous knowledge when we come back into the world. So these spacecraft are often about death and immortality and fear of immortality for me. And you probably know about Elon Musk's red sports car in space, launched February 2018. Literally a red sports car with a mannequin sitting in it wearing a space visor. And it's terribly symbolic in ways that do not reflect well on Mr. E. Musk, in my opinion, but quite intriguing from that perspective. And he said at one point in a tweet, as it happens, he said that he was really invigorated by the idea that millions of years from now, this object that represents him will still be out in space as like a grave monument or a memorial. So I really think there is some sort of strong feelings about death and our ephemeral existence, and somehow space objects representing an armor against mortality that I think the Voyagers have, that red sports car has. It has all that other stuff too. I'm not even going to articulate it because you either know what I'm talking about or you don't. So people will say, I hate this actually. They'll say space exploration is about the deep human urge to explore. Well, I say bullshit. I don't think that exists, but there is certainly a deep human urge or a deep human need to engage with our own mortality. This is what a lot of these spacecraft, not in near-Earth orbit because they're generally really functional, but deep space probes, sure, we want to know about the other planets, but the numerous ones we've sent out with these sort of messages are about that. They are about the human condition at that kind of level. So I don't know. That's
Dr. Alice Gorman, space archaeologist and space psychologist.
Uh-oh.
Alice, you've talked really evocatively about the kind of concern with death that's sort of embedded in so many of the ways we talk about space and engage with space. The other theme that really leaps out to me through what you've been saying and in your book is this kind of really pervasive colonial language and colonial metaphors that really infiltrate so much of, you know, how we talk about space and imagine it. So I'm interested in how your background working in Indigenous archaeology, which, you know, is obviously in Australia very related to colonialism, how that kind of informs your thinking about space.
Yeah. So I think for me, that whole background was from the beginning. It was very much part of how I decided to analyse these places and these artefacts. And so after I'd had my little revelation about the possible heritage value of space junk, I started researching Australia's space history. And of course, our premier space site is the Woomera rocket launch range. And I guess simply because I came from that background, when I started to read the technical literature, I was asking the question, which we know the answer to, it's sort of like, well, where were the traditional owners? They were there. We know that they were always there. So what happened? What was going on in this time? So this led me to doing, I suppose, the same kind of research that I would once have done for an actual heritage consulting job, like going back into the archives to find out what I could about the events that were left out of all of the published history. So it's really interesting in space. It's a very widely used metaphor or trope or something that is sort of like from the Stone Age to the Space Age. And of course they're very heavily criticised because they're 18th century stuff, but it's like the minute you put something spacey onto something, it erased everything else underneath. So I knew that that narrative that was emerging in the space stuff I was reading, I knew that wasn't true, and I knew I had to find out what was going on. This led me to, well, first of all, with Woomera, which is just down the road, 5 hours drive from us in South Australia, looking at the process of how that decision was made to locate the rocket range there, what the implications were for the traditional owners, what impacts it had on them, and then making an argument that the heritage significance of Woomera as a place was not just about technology and Australia's place in global space industry, but it was also about that process, which was a largely, not entirely, but, you know, it's never that simple, but largely not a great process for Kokoda people and Pitjantjatjara people and various other traditional owner groups in the very huge area the rocket range covered. But those maybe not entirely positive experiences were as much of part of the heritage values, the cultural significance of that place, as the fact that Australia was the third nation on Earth to launch a satellite from within its own borders from Woomera. And then I started to look at this pattern in other places. So one of these was the Kourou launch site in French Guiana. Another one was the French launch sites in Algeria, and fairly similar kinds of patterns, very different kinds of people, but very similar narratives. And, you know, in Australia there was this very strong thing that Aboriginal people were just doomed to die out. That was just an inevitable natural process. There was nothing that could be done to stop it. And unsurprisingly, you get that same narrative in these other countries as well. So for some of the world's major rocket launch sites, there is this displacement and alienation of Indigenous people from land that was once theirs. And specifically, so launching rockets is very dangerous. So generally you want to locate these places where there's a low population. Where is there a low population where colonial processes have, through disease, through massacre, through all of those other things, actually removed people? And so the apparently empty land appears that way for particular reasons, not because just randomly, oh, look, here's a nice place for rockets to be launched from. So it was made empty. It was literally made empty.
Yeah.
It's interesting, in Australia, around the time Woomera was set up, there was a big debate about, well, this could be great. This could be jobs for Aboriginal people. You know, I'm quite sure many of them would have been quite happy to have been employed in space industry, but this wasn't how it worked out. I mean, it's a whole other complex history here around Aboriginal people and labour history in Australia as well. So they were kept on the outside of the space age story. They were put into the Stone Age and kept there, while the rest of the space age supposedly, you know, just went along that natural human urge to explore stuff, which to me is interesting, because when historians and space people talk about the human urge to explore, it's funny who that doesn't include. So Indigenous people aren't held to have an urge to explore. If you start to break it down, that whole urge to explore thing is full of cracks, but people are quite attached to it.
Well, that whole language, urge to explore, I mean, it's a deeply colonial language that, you know, these powerful, normally white men need to go out and understand and dominate other places, whether that's other places on Earth or other places in space.
Explore is a kind of synonym for conquer.
Exactly.
I try not to use all of those terms, and sometimes there are big debates. You can imagine there's a little bit of resistance from the space establishment to being asked to speak in a different way. A lot of people are like, yes, it would be great to not take that as the foundation of the way we speak about how we're going to go into space. But some of these concepts are so strong and so resilient, it can be really difficult to kind of make sure that you're not perpetuating some of these ideas, because that's how everybody else around you is kind of looking at it.
Well, we've talked in previous episodes of Archive Fever about the notion of decolonising the archive, and it sounds like maybe you're part of that process too.
Well, it'd be nice to think I could, you know, make some sort of impact on
decolonising the space archive.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that tends to come from colonialism, as we know, is sort of sovereignty claims. But space is one region that thankfully, you know, at least for the moment, doesn't have any territorial claims over it. But I'm curious about the implications for that in terms of this kind of heritage management question that you started with, that if no one owns space, then who has responsibility for managing the heritage of space, for all this space junk that is, as you've explained, so valuable?
There are sovereignty implications of thinking about heritage, exactly as you identify. So the US, for example, one of my colleagues from the States, Beth Laura O'Leary, was one of the first people to work on the lunar site. So she did a catalogue of all the objects at Apollo 11. Under the terms of the Outer Space Treaty, the launching state is responsible for the objects. It does own them, but at the very most, the launching center is liable for damage caused by the objects that it's launched. So she made inquiries about whether the Apollo 11 site could be put onto the National Landmarks Register in the US. And NASA responded to this by saying that that could be interpreted as a territorial claim. Now, this is very ironic, because sticking a bloody great US flag in lunar soil could be interpreted as making a territorial claim. So let's not worry about that right now. But, you know, heritage, that's a whole different thing. Now what's happened is the objects, which are owned by the US, are registered in the states of California and New Mexico as significant to US history, but the site is not, because the site would be a territorial claim. I think it's possible to have, and we do have them on Earth, we have indicative heritage lists. We have one in Australia, the Overseas Heritage List, set up by John Howard, with three places on them of a mostly military-related nature. So we have no sovereignty in Turkey. Gallipoli is one of those places. We have no sovereignty there. We can't do anything. We're legally detached. It's not part of Australia. But a moral obligation is created. So it's identified as something of value to Australian people. And should it be required, and this has happened, you know, Australian heritage people work with Turkish people to get good outcomes for the heritage at that place. So that's a great precedent, I think, for some of this stuff. So there isn't any sovereignty involved in that. There's no way to interpret that as a territorial claim, but there is a recognition and a mechanism for cooperation. And I think it wouldn't be too hard to think of ways to extend that into space. And I suppose we have to think about whose heritage we're choosing to protect through thinking through these mechanisms. And again, drawing on my experience looking at the rocket ranges in different parts of the world, I think the next part of those stories is, sure, there's all the technological stuff and all of that stuff as well, but it's to draw in and fold in stories of people who were explicitly excluded from these places, to take their interpretations and their meanings, which again, the Borough Charter is an easy mechanism to make happen, so that we won't get a continuing valorisation of that colonial narrative. We'll actually get the thing that people say they want, which is a space that's free and open for all people.
Alice, moving back to the beginning of our conversation where you were describing the symptoms of your archive fever, you did happen to mention the bindings on the archives that you were so enamoured of. And there's quite a lengthy section on cable ties in your book. So I'm wondering whether you have something, a particular passion for bindings, and what on earth are cable ties doing in space?
Yes, they're like old-fashioned stationery now. And I love the string ones. You know how they've got like little cardboard buttons and the string winds around them. And I like those flower-shaped metal ones with the two prongs that you spread out. And, you know, sometimes you're not allowed to undo the bindings in the things as well. So I suppose they're kind of like an invitation and a barrier at the same time. And you can't buy these things anymore. This is vintage stationery, you know. There's something very appealing about that. But, you know, I hadn't actually thought to put this together in my head with cable ties, which you have just done for me. So cable ties, the little thin straps of plastic, and you put the one end with ridges on it into the little house at the top, pull it tight, and there you go. Something is fastened.
It's very low tech considering the high tech stuff that you've otherwise described being up there in space.
This is what I love about it. So I was first alerted to the role of cable ties in aerospace technology when I was doing a survey, an archaeological survey of a NASA tracking station outside the ACT that was decommissioned in the mid-1980s. And all of the above-ground stuff had been destroyed. It was just concrete footprints. So I was sort of focusing on what was under the ground, which archaeologists tend to do, I guess. And by doing a geophysical survey, we realised that the cable trenches were still there, often with cables still in them. And this was a site with, you know, 6 to 9 antennas all the time pointed at the sky, pulling down satellite data or sending signals to satellites. So I started to focus on the cables as part of that technology. And on my second trip, I started to notice discarded cable ties scattered across the ground. We did a systematic pedestrian survey, and it was just, oh, they're cable ties, they're just these bits of plastic. But in fact, when you started to analyze them, there was a huge amount of variation in their colour, their length, their thickness, in their weight-bearing load. Going into their history, they were invented in 1958. They start with the space age, and yet now they're in everyone's house, everyone's garage, everyone who goes on a camping trip, in the boot of people's cars, walk along a street and you'll see broken cable ties because they're used to fasten posters and corflute boards and all kinds of things to telegraph poles and bus shelters. They're so ubiquitous that people don't even notice them, and yet they came to be in this particular point in time. They started in aerospace, they migrated into the everyday world, and they are in space. They're used on the International Space Station. There are space qualified cable ties that are blue in colour, radiation hardened, because it's a very savage radiation environment in space. So we have this little plastic object that goes from the surface of the Earth all the way out to the ends of Earth orbit. It straddles so many worlds and so many technologies. And maybe, yeah, just like the bindings on the wodges, the big folders of documents in the archives that you kind of undo carefully and then carefully turn the pages. Maybe the cable ties are like those fastenings, you know. Maybe you don't have the documents anymore, but from the nature of the cable tie, you can figure out something about what it once held.
Mm. So it's kind of an object that points to an absence in a way.
Yes, I think so. Very much so.
So to finish up now, we'll ask you the question we like to ask all our guests on Archive Fever. If you have a dirty little archive secret you'd be willing to share with us today.
So probably the worst thing I've ever done in the archives is undo the documents when I was not supposed to, looking over my shoulder the whole while to make sure that the archivists were not watching me so that I could get at the stuff that was cut off in the margins because of the way they were bound together. So I realise probably in some circles that is a terrible sin, but it's maybe not the worst thing a person has ever done in the archives. Although I suppose I could say this is slightly different. In the Pitt Rivers Museum, I dropped a glass artefact and broke it into two pieces and then I put it back in the box.
Did you tell anyone?
No.
Well, 3 Hail Marys for your first sin and 10 for the second.
And just, you know, 100 lashes.
I will take them with humility.
Alice, thank you so much for coming into Archives Anonymous today to chat with us. It's been fascinating and I would like to say quite mind-blowing, actually. I will never think about the stars or cable ties quite the same way again.
My job here is done.
To learn more about Alice's work, you can follow her on Twitter at Dr. Space Junk or visit her Flinders University profile.
So until next time, I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright. And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast recorded and produced by Matt Smith. This episode was recorded at Podbooth Production Studio on Kaurna land in Adelaide and produced on Wurundjeri land in Melbourne. Kaurna and Wurundjeri sovereignty was never ceded, and we pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging.
You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you choose to listen. Our theme music is by Poddington Bear. You can hear more at soundofpicture.com. And if you're new to our little nerd cult here, you can catch up on all the episodes of Archive Fever, plus a whole bunch of nerdy links and photos on our website, archivefeverpod.com.
And you can follow Eve on Twitter at Eve Rees.
And you can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Wright or on Instagram at Claire Wright Historian. Coming up on the next episode.
But the ice, of course, is its own archive. It archives the Earth's atmosphere. And in fact, when we think about non-paper archives, archives that humans haven't made, we really, I think, can crack open what it means to write history, what history is.